Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Lord Grantham himself, Hugh Bonneville, on his new movie To Olivia, where he plays Roald Dahl. Eve Hewson and Tom Bateman on Netflix's new series Behind Her Eyes. Rather creepy show and a very good one too. Davy Fitzgerald, the man himself, talks to me about his favourite movie. Plus Mark Ryle on Rosamund Pike's blistering performance in the new movie I Care A Lot. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, the Newstalk app, wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. Good weekend to you all. Hope you're doing okay. There's a huge amount on the show this week, so I don't have any time at all really to tell you about, I don't know, the things I normally tell you about, what I've been watching and other curiosities of the week. That said, I do want to quickly mention a lovely email I got from Kerry McCarthy in the great state of New Jersey. Someone listening all the way in New Jersey every week. Lovely email about their lives over there and how important Irish radio is and Screen Time in particular is to them, which is lovely to get. But I did want to mention one thing Kerry said, where he said that basically the best thing in the show was the segment with Mark Ryle. And I quote, "The segments with Mark Ryle are so fantastic that they make me feel like I'm doing something illegal. My work here is done." Thank you, Kerry. Also last week, a lot of people again telling me to watch The Night of the Demon. So it took me a while to get it. I have my hands on it. I will watch it this week. I will report back next week. A lot of people in touch saying it was a great movie from the 50s that I should watch, and I will do. It's only taken me 4 weeks to get around to it, but I will. And quickly also just want to mention Blue Bloods, the greatest piece of cheese on Sky Witness, has returned. It's cheesy, but I love it. And incredibly, it's back for its 11th season, even though it's not adored by critics or anything. It's a wildly successful show about a family of cops, legal people, in this family in New York. It's cheesy as hell, but it's great. And it was back with a bang this week with a serial killer. Also seemed to be making reference to COVID New York. I thought the first episode was great. Now, To Olivia is a brand new movie all about Roald Dahl and Patricia Neal, who were married in real life, the author and the actress, and they had a couple of children. One of them sadly died, called Olivia. She died of measles, and given the fact that we're all talking about vaccines now, she clearly wouldn't have if there had have been a proper vaccination program for her at the time. The movie To Olivia tells about the death of the child and how it affected Roald Dahl's and Patricia Neal's marriage, and not just the tragedy of that, but also where they went after that. Take a listen to this.
"My name is Roald Dahl, and this is my wife, Patricia Neal, star of stage and screen. We had two daughters, Olivia and Tessa."
"Olivia?"
"But a story can have many pages."
"Where were we?"
"Chapter 5.
Ah, yes.
Spark's gone out of you, hasn't it, darling?
You have to fix it before it's so broken. Can't be fixed anymore.
We all become stories in the end. Don't you think she'd like to be remembered with a happy one?
One gobstopper, please.
I want you to be in my picture, Pat.
Patricia Neal for Paul Newman.
This big marshmallow mountain.
I like that. That's a very good idea.
Many people have called Charlie and Chocolate Factory one of the finest children's books.
Do you like it?"
"I love it."
"I rather think she would have liked it as well. To Olivia."
Roald Dahl is played into Olivia by the wonderful Hugh Bonneville, who starred in everything from Downton Abbey, of course, to W&A, to movies like The Monuments Men. And I got to talk to him about the movie and a bit more besides. So listen, I'm a father myself of three. And, you know, it's in the balance sheet of life, it's that incalculable loss, the idea of losing a child. As an actor, does a part of you kind of balk at that level of grief, or as an actor do you go, I can really do something with this, which you clearly did?
I think, well, like you as a parent, of course, it's every parent's worst nightmare, the loss of a child. And that's the central, structure of this film. But what I really liked about it was the honesty of the journey through grief, that I think anyone who's lost anyone will recognize. Yeah. That mixture of dark humor sometimes, of anger, of confusion, of bargaining with yourself. If only I'd done this, it would have been different, etc. I think it's a very honest encapsulation of the journey of grief that Roald Dahl and Patricia go on. So that was the first thing that really I found, affecting when I read the script. But secondly, the fact that this actually isn't a rosy marriage. It's not they're not a rosy couple. By her own admission, when she married Roald, she was still in love with, Patricia was still in love with the film star Gary Cooper, which had an affair. So there was baggage in this marriage. So there was a crack in it before you've even started. They had three gorgeous children. They'd already, Theo, the youngest, had had a brain injury when the pram he was in had been hit by a taxi in New York. And so they'd been through immense, he recovered, thankfully, but they'd been through immense pain with that. And then the loss of Olivia when she was seven to measles was, of course, was immensely tragic. But so these different layers, these different textures, the fact that it wasn't, all roses and wasn't just all grief. There was, this extraordinary roller coaster. Made it incredibly attractive. It's so brilliantly written, I think, and honest in its brutality of pain, but also its optimism towards the end. So I think it makes it it's a nourishing watch, so to speak.
It certainly is. And as Leonard Cohen says, there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in, just to throw a bit of Leonard Cohen.
Very good.
So Roald Dahl himself, I read some of the reviews, which I try not to do, but for some reason I did. And they said, you're good at being how cranky he was. And my memory of him, seeing him as a kid on TV and interviews, was that he was very cranky. But I actually thought your portrayal was quite jolly at times. Like, it wasn't just curmudgeonly. Did you do a lot of getting around who he was? Did you read up a lot to be as true to it? Or again, is it acting? Do you just take it on board and go where you're going to go with it?
Well, no, our writers, John and Dave, they did many, many iterations. And I kept saying, we need to, don't shy away from the fact that he was quite a dark man, by many accounts, at many points. He was also very entertaining when he wanted to be. I've met a couple of people of a senior generation now who say, oh, when I was a kid, I got my book signed by him in a book launch. And I said, oh, that must have been fun. And they said, no, he hated being there. You could tell him it wasn't fun at all. So he was a man, he didn't take any prisoners, and he was probably clearly a tough man to live with, but he also had great wit. And I think he and Patricia, that's why when it clicked, they really had a very fine relationship for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. They were married 30 years. It didn't last ultimately, but they, they had children together, and he was devoted to those children, clearly, even though he was also clearly a man with volatility. He suffered a lot of pain himself. He'd crashed in the desert and been in hospital for months. They'd had this accident with Theo and then the loss of Olivia. This was a very complex man and a complex relationship. And so that was interesting to play. But I think you can't just play. It would have been quite dull to play the curmudgeonly dark man throughout.
And I'm sure I'm not the first person to say this, but the strange dovetailing of events, like, it's not a spoiler, Olivia dies of measles. If that was today, she'd probably be never even hospitalized. And here we are talking about vaccines today. And I know you've been even volunteering in a vaccine center in the UK. This dovetailing of events must be spine tingling for you in a way, is it?
It's very strange, whenever you make a film that suddenly strange resonances, ping around that you'd never anticipated. We shot this over a year ago before the pandemic. But Roald and Patricia were passionate advocates of the measles vaccine when it became available. A reliable one wasn't available when Olivia died. Yeah. And he writes eloquently about the pain of that loss and also about you know, the simple fact that had there been a vaccine, my daughter would still be alive. Please take the vaccine. And so, you know, it's a discussion that's going on all over the world right now. I am in the camp that believes the vaccine is a vital tool in getting us out of this mess that the world is in. And, you know, I sincerely hope that those who, you know, have not yet had it will consider doing so.
You'll be pleased to hear I was talking to a doctor yesterday, and we started with the 85-year-olds here, and 100% of the people who went to see him yesterday took it without qualms here in dear old Ireland. You'll be pleased to hear.
That's great to hear.
Listen, can I ask you two things briefly outside of the movie? One, and this is a really simple yes or no, I'm a massive Bill Murray fan. In my misspent youth, I served him a drink in a country club in New York, and I've adored him ever since because he's a fine actor. So I simply want you to tell me that it was wonderful to work with him, and he was the funniest man you ever met on The Monuments Man, or some close approximation of that.
You're pretty much right. You're absolutely spot on. He was, I could talk for hours about Bill Murray. He is the most mercurial, entertaining, odd, gorgeous human being that you could hope to meet, and great fun on a film set.
Wonderful. Well, correct answer. Thank you. And the last thing, I'm sure in the last 10 years, you've never done an interview where Downton Abbey hasn't come up. And this will be no exception. What I just wanted to know is, like, about halfway through the first series of filming it, did you have a sense that, like, this thing is becoming almost a TV monster? Like, when did that dawn on you? This is crazy. Because Downton, even that word now, is like an adjective when people go to review things. It's just crazy how big it became. And I was wondering when that dawned on you that, you know, we're not in Kansas anymore with this.
Yeah, I think it wasn't during the first, it certainly wasn't during the shooting of the first season. I think I can pin it down to roughly, well, there were two events. The second, when the second episode went out and the ratings went up, which, okay, is not unheard of, but it's very, very unusual.
Yeah.
So because obviously there's a lot of, you know, media splash when a show launches, and then everyone goes, yeah, I'm not interested. And it dropped by 10 or more percent, yeah, at least. And ours went up. And so that was strange. And then about 5 weeks in, I remember being in the playground ready to pick up my son. And one of the other lads, you know, who was about 9 or so, came up and said, I don't like that Thomas character. And I thought, you're 9. What are you doing watching our show? Yeah. And he began to realize that it was just spreading across the demographic, that it wasn't just for people who watch costume dramas on a Sunday, yeah, night at 9 o'clock. It was actually, there were kids getting into it, and gradually realized that there were teenage girls who loved the girls' dresses, and, you know, that I, grannies writing and saying, it's lovely, I can watch this with my granddaughter, my grandson, my family. And he, that's when it began to, you know. And so by the second, when we went back to film the second season, here was another litmus test. Highclere Castle, the manager of the house, yeah, he said that when we filmed in the first year, they were getting 60 coach loads. By the second season, they were getting 600 coach loads come to, wow, visit. So you sort of realize that things were beginning to mushroom, you know. Yeah. Now they can pretty much build a, you know, helipad on the roof at Highclere. But yeah, it's been a funny old journey.
Well, you should get some commission for Highclere maybe. But anyway, listen, it was lovely to talk to Hugh. Thanks a lot for talking to me.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
Hugh Bonneville there talking to me about Downton Abbey, Bill Murray, and of course the new movie, which is now on Sky Cinema and also on Now TV, To Olivia. That's from the 19th, Friday the 19th of February. Up next, Eve Hewson and Tom Bateman on your next Netflix binge.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Now, I want to tell you about a new Netflix series called Behind Her Eyes, which was based on a very successful novel from a couple of years ago. It started streaming on Netflix on Wednesday, and it stars Tom Bateman as a psychiatrist who moves to a new town with his somewhat troubled wife, Adele. Now, Tom inadvertently meets a woman in a bar one night, kisses her, runs away, and then it turns out she's going to be his assistant in the office he's just moved to as a psychiatrist. In tandem with all this, his wife Adele, who's played very well by Eve Hewson, a great Irish actress, up-and-coming Irish actress, or maybe she's already arrived, it's probably fair to say. And Adele clearly has a troubled past that Tom helped her with. Now, a love triangle begins, and Adele befriends his assistant, Louise, and they become friends, even though Louise is having an affair with Tom. In tandem with all this, there's a weird, strange dream thing going on, all about lucid dreaming, where people can learn to control their dreams. And Louise and Adele are both able to do this to a certain extent, to varying degrees. There are lots of twists in this, and particularly at the end, a massive one, which I'm very keen not to give away. This is only 6 episodes long, and I think it might be your next binge, because it's really one you want to go straight on to the next episode with. As I mentioned, Adele is played by Eve Ewson. People know her as Bono's daughter, but I think that's kind of facile at this stage to say, because she's so much more than that. She starred opposite James Gandolfini, for goodness sake. So I got to speak to Eve Hewson, who plays Adele, and also the great English actor Tom Bateman. His character is called David in Behind Her Eyes. Take a listen to this. You know, people say things, oh, it's like peeling an onion, but this really was. There's so many times that you're going, wow, that happened. I really don't know what's going on here. Is that kind of what spoke to you about it, that there were so many layers?
Yeah, it was more like chopping an onion furiously over and over again. The scripts were amazing, and it was just a sort of an exciting project I've never done before, and I was really excited to do this kind of genre. So that's what attracted me to it.
And Tom, you know, I don't want to give away spoilers, but there are definitely serious twists, and then there's massive one at one point, which we won't get into. And I know there was a book and all, so people may be aware of it. But was this something new for you as well? Because the twist that comes is a real 180.
Yeah, it is. It's even more than 180. It's kind of like suddenly looking up and down as well. You're going, wait a second.
Sorry, I'm not great with maths. Sorry.
it was completely. And I think what I loved was the crazy narrative, with the amount of thinking, oh my god, now I get the twist, oh my god, no I don't, oh my god, now I get it, no I don't. Every single chapter almost in the book, you're like, wait a minute, you can't have this many twists in one story. But what was really fascinating and drew me to it as an actor was then thinking, well, how do you play a lot of those scenes? Because it's a huge amount of like back catalog that you have, your backstories there.
Sure.
It's amazing. But then you kind of, I'd say to Eric sometimes, I'm like, I could play the scene 10 different ways because, you know, because of this line meaning this and this line meaning this. And Steve Lightfoot did a really great job of like really, really working like to a fine detail with specific words that the character chooses to use. Mm-hmm. So, and that was why it really appealed to me. I thought, I don't know where I'd start. So therefore I can't wait to get stuck in. Often if you read something, you go, yeah, I know what that is. I can do that. Then you know what I mean? You're half asleep the whole time.
Yeah. And there's also the thing that, and this isn't a spoiler, but it's very unclear for a while if you're a good guy or a bad guy, which must be fun.
Isn't that true of us all?
Yes. Oh, definitely. Absolutely.
No.
You're in great company with me anyway.
Yeah.
Eve, the dreaming sequences are fascinating. And this whole idea of lucid dreaming and, you know, waking yourself up in a dream, it's kind of mind bending. Did you guys like practice that? Did you meet sleep psychology people and learn how to do that?
Yeah, we did. We had this sort of lucid dreaming astral projection seminar. We had this amazing professor. I think she's a prof. She has like a PhD in it.
Yeah.
And she came and she gave us a lecture, and then we did a workshop where we did a whole meditation, and she gave us a specific music that she uses. And, you know, I think there was a few days during rehearsal where we all went home and listened to this weird meditation music and tried to astral project at night.
Wow. So can you now lucid dream?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what's that like?
Well, I didn't do it, but she says it's the moment, you know, when you're falling asleep and you all of a sudden you start to see images, but you're not entirely asleep yet. You're kind of in and out. You wake up. That's the moment where you go into it, basically.
Mm. Okay.
So it's a specific skill that I don't think any of us really grasped, but...
I think it takes a long time, doesn't it? I don't think she, because it was an amazing day, because I remember saying to like friends and stuff, what are you doing today? I'm like, well, I'm doing an astral projection workshop in Kilburn. But she did say, didn't she? She said it's a long time. She goes, it's like meditation. It takes years and years and years. You can't just go, I'm going to give you 3 easy steps and you're going to be flying around Hampstead Heath.
Yeah.
you know.
Yeah, no, of course not. Eve, can I ask you about one other thing outside of this? And that's the movie Enough Said, which was the first thing I ever saw you in, which is 2013, I think. So it's a while ago now. But I am evangelical about James Gandolfini as an actor because I adored The Sopranos. It's probably my favorite thing ever, like of any art form. And you were great in that as well. I'm wondering what kind of experience that was to play his daughter in what sadly turned out to be his last ever role.
Yeah, I feel really, really lucky. It was the beginning of my career. I was still in college. I think I was 20. I shot it in the summer of one year in college. And I kind of like to think of it as a blessing in some ways that I got to sort of meet him and work with him and learn from him before he passed. Mm. But I'm also slightly heartbroken, you know, just I when we met, he kind of took me in and he was such a wonderful, almost father figure. And I was really looking forward to sort of being friends with him and continuing a friendship. So it was very, very sad when he passed, but I'm still feel blessed that I got to meet him and work with him.
Yeah, rightly so. And Tom, just in terms of career things, you're getting back on the Kenneth Branagh wagon, I understand, for Death on the Nile. I have a sense that, and you previously did, it's terrible. It's gone out of my head. What was
Orient Express?
Orient Express, sorry. Trains. I'm terrible with trains. I'm wondering the Kenneth Branagh set and set up. It seems people adore working on one of his productions. It's a real kind of family kind of vibe, and he just knows how to do things the way no one else does. Is it a fun experience to be on a Branagh set? I get the impression it is.
Yeah, massively. I'd literally do anything with him if he asked me to. So I was over the moon to work when they asked me to come and do the second. They wrote me in. I'm not supposed to be in it. They just wrote my character in. So I was over the moon. But I think a big thing with him is that he's so... the family thing is he uses a lot of the same people. Of course, he brings in new people, but a lot of his crew are the same people. So there is a nice family feel, but he just knows what he wants. And also because he is an actor, he knows how to talk to actors. He knows how to make everything light. He'll be like really intense and focused and then manage to every day lighten everything up, make fun and stuff. So it's a real joy. And I went literally straight on. They wrapped me up off Behind Her Eyes. And literally, you know, a couple of days later, I was on set with Ken and the new guys. And it was great because my heart was breaking leaving Evie and Simona and stuff. And it really was. I was really like, do you know what I mean? I love
my heart. My heart was broken. I was like, I can't believe you're leaving me.
Yeah, I was literally mortified. So to be able to, if I had just left, I'd have been left with a heart broken. But it was like I got to sort of move on to a really joyful experience. So I was very lucky.
Yeah. And Eve, what's next for you then after you finish talking to people like me about Behind Her Eyes?
There's something very cool. It's very Irish.
Oh, okay.
And it's very fun.
Okay.
So different.
Yeah.
But that's all I'm saying.
Fair enough. That's good enough for me. Irish and funny, you know, we can work with that. That's worked well in the past. And then Tom, just back to Behind Her Eyes. Like I was saying to someone that I was going to be talking to you guys later and they were saying, what kind of thing is it? And I was saying, well, it's kind of a psychological drama, but there is a touch of horror about it. And then I kind of ran out of a way of describing. It really is kind of genre bending this, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think really like that's what is really exciting about material that people are making in movies and in TV shows right now is people are really pushing the boundaries. Cause I think we've got so much out there to get something made and to really make an impact. You either have to be the best, but often that's not even good enough. You need to make the best thing, but also something that is very, very different. So people go, wait a minute, that's nuts. They did this weird ass thing. Have you seen this? And not that it's anything like it, but I watched Watchmen in lockdown,
yes,
which I was just blown away that this could get made on TV. I was thinking 10 years ago, I don't think you could make this. I don't think people would stomach it almost. Do you know what I mean? But it made me go, wow, you can do this huge concept, this amazing piece, so well done. And I hope that hunger and that, that people can digest that. I hope it does well, because this is like that. It's kind of so many different things mixed into one.
Yeah, and it's also binge worthy. You know, it's a type of thing you could watch in two nights and rush home from work to go. Rush home from your bedroom, but you know, to say, oh, I have to watch this. So you did a great job. It's great TV, and thanks a lot for talking to me.
Oh, thanks, man.
Top you up?
No, thanks. Two's my limit.
Oh, that's no fun.
Table full of psychiatrists. I like to keep my wits about me.
You're probably very wise.
Well, as I know the truth,
we're just as messed up as anyone else. Just better at hiding it.
Then you don't want me getting drunk and sharing all your secrets.
Ooh. And there you heard a little clip from Behind Her Eyes, which is now streaming on Netflix. And before that, you heard me talking to Eve Hewson and Tom Bateman, who star in it. And it is well worth a watch, Behind Her Eyes. 6 episodes, mega twists and turns in it. You'll enjoy it. It's kind of thriller, touch of vague horror about it, melodrama. It's got a lot going on. As I say, it might be your next binge. You're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. It's that stage of the week where we turn to new release time. This week, we're looking at the movie we talked about earlier with Hugh Bonneville, To Olivia, on Sky Cinema. And also a movie I found fascinating and intriguing called I Care A Lot. Someone I care even more about is our resident critic, Mark Ryle, who's here to review the same said movies. Mark, how are you?
I'm living the dream, John, you know. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. All the better for having you in my ears, even if I can't see you, you know. So can we start backwards? Can we start with I Care A Lot?
Absolutely, yeah.
Rosamund Pike, what's going on here?
This it came out of nowhere. It was like a stealth torpedo. It was written and directed by a guy called Jay Blakeson, and he doesn't exactly have a stellar track record. He directed a completely forgettable sci-fi called The Fifth Wave a few years back. And I knew next to nothing about this, and I wasn't expecting much either, but it really is fantastic. I'm not sure you can describe it as a black comedy, but it is certainly black. Rosamund Pike is Marla Grayson. She's a really nasty, horrible, heartless, vicious piece of work. She is a legal scam artist, and she makes a lot of money by getting morally flexible doctors to diagnose elderly patients as being unfit to look after themselves. And then Marla steps in and gets a judge to appoint her as the patient's sole professional guardian, after which she sticks them in a care home and then strip mines every last resort she can squeeze out of them, from their homes right down to their gold fillings. So, you know, it's sick and it's twisted and it's morally bankrupt, and I loved it.
As did I, and I completely agree with you in that it came out of nowhere. Like I barely even read what it was about, and about 10 minutes in I was into this wild, dark, funny ride. I mean, it is a comedy just because she's so grotesque in her amoral way of doing things, but it is comedic as well, because just so many bizarre things happen. And I guess we should say as well that she then, you know, where the action really heats up is when she messes with the wrong stooge, basically, right?
Yeah. I'll be honest, when I started watching this, I wasn't sure how much I was going to be able to take, because Rosamund Pike's character is so morally bereft and cynical, and what she's doing is so apparent that I honestly felt grubby just watching it. But then around 25 to 30 minutes in, it takes a turn, and I said, oh, this is clever. And I don't want to go into it in too much detail, but it starts off and you think, I'm able for this, but it doesn't stay that way. It's not just the bobbing and the weaving story that this guy Blakeson has come up with, but it's what Pike does with the material. And it's a testament to her talent that I found myself rooting for her, because she is an absolute monster. That's her character. But I was still rooting for her at a certain point, you know. And Rosamund Pike, she's given some absolutely vicious dialogue here. But it's not just the dialogue and how she delivers it, but it's what's going on in her facial expressions and her body language, even when she's not speaking, when she's just taking in her surroundings and, you know, master planning. I think she's doing a lot, even when she's not doing a lot, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. And also, though, when she's being mean to people, she's doing it in the icy coldest way that's petrifying in her evilness. But yet it's kind of verging on the comic as well. As we said, we have to mention Peter Dinklage, because
Peter Dinklage, he's tremendous.
He comes into it and he is also equally scary and just brilliant in it.
He is, yeah, he is. Poor old Diane Wiest as well.
Diane Wiest is in it. Yes, yeah. I should have mentioned that. An actress I remember from a lot of Woody Allen movies and other places, Parenthood and all sorts. It was nice to see her again.
Yeah, she is. The cast is brilliant, but like for me, Pike is, she's consistently brilliant, and she's one of those actors like Mark Strong is another one, but they noticeably and significantly improve any movie just by their presence. And this role, it's quite similar to the one she did in David Fincher's Gone Girl, in that she's another sociopath with this laser guided unwavering focus on what she wants. And Gone Girl seems to be on TV an awful lot lately for one reason or another, but I think it's one of those movies that once I hit on it, I can't go past it and I have to start watching it. I'm not sure if I could watch I Care a Lot more than once, but that isn't to say that it's not a fantastic movie.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's almost too emotionally draining. You often talk about the music in movies. I thought the music was great because it felt like Miami Vice or something, like an 80s soundtrack that never kind of left. There was all this heavy synth music when the action really got going.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up, actually, because
surprise, I have Don Johnson right here.
I think the score was by Mark Carnahan, but I found it, I found it a bit overbearing and distracting.
So did I. Sorry, yeah. I didn't like it at all.
I did actually think that the score was seemed a little bit out of place. But I mean, you know, it doesn't take away. I mean, it's a fantastic piece of work.
Yeah, no, well, I like the music. But anyway, look, it doesn't matter. It's on Amazon, we should say. What would you say stars-wise?
I'm going to give it 4. It's tremendous. It's like a secret weapon.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I'm going to give it a 4 as well. I said earlier in the week somewhere I was verging towards 5, but that might be overdoing it. But it's a great dark thriller. 4 it is. Let's take a quick clip.
Good morning, Miss Peterson. I'm sorry to disturb you so early. The court has ruled that you require assistance in taking care of yourself.
I'm fine.
I'm afraid it's not up to you to decide. The court has appointed me to be your legal guardian.
What?
You have to come with me. And remember, I'm here to help.
A clip there from I Care a Lot, now available on Amazon. And Mark Ryle and I gave it 4 stars apiece. Mark, we spoke a good bit about To Olivia earlier in the show because I had the lovely and the very talented Hugh Bonneville on. This is a story all about Roald Dahl and Patricia Neal, as played by Keely Hawes and Hugh Bonneville, dealing with the death of a child. What did you make of this?
It fits into that subgenre of movies that take the trauma of beloved children's authors and, you know, mines it for drama. Stuff like, I think Saving Mr. Banks is probably the high watermark, but you're talking about stuff like, you know, Goodbye Christopher Robin and Miss Potter as well. I don't need to rehash what the story is, because I'm sure we're all well aware of what it's about at this stage. I'm embarrassed to admit this, but I had no idea that Patricia Neal was married to Roald Dahl.
Really? I thought that you would have known that, given the type of stuff you know.
So did I. I had no idea. I do now, anyway.
You had no idea, you didn't know. Socratic ignorance, I think that is.
Yeah. I know my weaknesses. I suppose it's essentially about a parent holding on to grief because it's the only thing that's left of their child, and you know, this grief that can't be overcome or beaten, and it destroys everything in its path. Those couple of movies that I mentioned earlier, I think it's To Olivia, I don't think it's quite as adventurous as those ones. It's a more traditional and, I suppose, old-fashioned and also televisual. I don't think that anything is going to be lost in not seeing this in a cinema. In fact, it'll probably help to watch it on the small screen. I did think that Keely Hawes, she grew into the role as the story progressed, And when the focus switches from the, you know, the domestic misery in the English countryside to the Hollywood legend in the making, it was a welcome change of pace for me when it came.
Well, it's on Sky Cinema, so a lot of people will be watching it at home. But what really did it for me was Hugh Bonneville as Roald Dahl and Keeley Hawes as Patricia Neal. I just thought they were brilliant. And as their marriage was ebbing and flowing and his dealing with the grief and the tragedy of it, I thought Bonneville really inhabited that really well, you know. And where they went afterwards as characters, I really liked as well.
Yeah, the only thing I'll say is that I really do wish that actors would be more wary and cautious around prosthetics. I think unless you're John Hurt in The Elephant Man, I think 99.9% of the time, there's no need for a fake nose. It's just distracting. I'm probably going to return to this topic whenever we're talking about Jesus and the Black Messiah gets a release, because poor Michael Sheen, and that looks like he's been beaten around the head with a frying pan. It's very distracting.
So are you making reference to Hugh Bonneville's
prosthetic nose? Yeah. I mean, I would have bought him as Roald Dahl without the fake nose.
I didn't even notice that. I never noticed that he had a fake nose. But anyway.
Really?
Yeah, and I did a Zoom call with him earlier in the week, so I saw him up close and personal, you know?
I presume he wasn't wearing the fake nose in the Zoom call.
No, I mean, we both dressed up for the occasion, but there was no fake nose. Anyway, I enjoyed it, though, I have to say. What would you say stars-wise?
I'm going to give it 2.5. It's the, really? I think it's the kind of thing that, like, it would fit perfectly into your Sunday night, and you wouldn't feel too badly about going to work then on Monday, if indeed any of us could leave our houses.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, well, no, I liked it a lot more than that. I thought they were brilliant as a troubled married couple. So I'm going to give it 3.5.
Okay.
For the same kind of reasons, I think it's a lovely kind of Sunday night movie, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, in a week of two halves, we're in desperate agreement with I Care a Lot and slight disagreement with To Olivia. But I'm in agreement of my approbation for you on this show, Mark.
Thank you, John.
To Olivia is available on Sky Cinema and also Now TV. And before that, we were talking about I Care a Lot, which is excellent, and it's on Amazon Prime. Up next, the inimitable Davy Fitzgerald on his favourite movie.
Screen Time on News Talk.
You're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. It's that stage of the week where I talk to someone well known about their favourite movie. And I'm delighted now to be joined by Wexford hurling manager and lately star of the TV and things like Davy's Toughest Challenge and Ireland's Fittest Family, Davy Fitzgerald. Hi, Davy, how are you?
I'm good, John. How are you?
Not too bad at all. So listen, usually we insist on a person picking one movie, but you've opted for two, and you know, you're too big to fail, as they used to say about banks. So will you tell our listeners your two favourite movies?
So the two I picked, which I love, is one, Seabiscuit, and two, Moneyball. Obviously, they're both sport, and so they have that dynamic to them. I suppose when you look at Seabiscuit, it comes from just being an underdog to getting to where Seabiscuit got to and achieving the ultimate at the end. And Moneyball is taking a team, managing budgets and beating the odds, beating the system. And I kind of like that kind of story. You know, I love the underdog.
Well, you see, when I heard Moneyball, I thought that film was kind of made for you. This guy who's poring over statistics and ways to get the best players, and not to give a spoiler, but it comes good in the end. Like, that movie was made for you.
Listen, it just intrigues me, like, of the way he went about stuff, how he looked at stuff. Like, they hadn't a chance of doing anything. Yet, he got this system in place. He was so tight to budgets. Next thing, he went back, he got another guy in to help him, and I couldn't take my eyes off it for the length of time it was on. It was brilliant.
Yeah. Do you ever use movies with any of the teams you've trained over the years? You know, there's stories of people playing clips of Al Pacino and dressing rooms and stuff like that. Did you ever go in for any of that?
Any Given Sunday?
Yeah.
Oh, of course I use them. Like, there were some great lines in it, you know. I've used that. I've used documentaries, maybe the Lions Tour and stuff like that. Like, I definitely would look back and stuff and think some of it is so inspirational. So to answer your question, yeah, I like TV. I like watching movies. So if I can find any bit of wisdom in anything, I definitely take it.
Yeah. And let me ask you then just about Seabiscuit. I haven't seen that in a long time, but, you know, that's ostensibly about a horse. I know it's the people around them all. What is it that really gets you about that?
Well, there's two things in it. One, like the horse was meant to be too small and that it wouldn't make it, and he was coming up against the really big horses and the big stables with all the money. And also his jockey, who overcame a massive injury to get back up and partner him to win Everton. It's something against the odds. I just kind of like that stuff, is seeing something that's had a lot of bad effects or a lot of bad things happen, and the next thing to come good at the end of it. Call me a softie, but I like it.
No, not at all. Now, well, that's great. Now, listen, you're all over our TV screens at the moment. Davy's Toughest Challenge, and of course, Ireland's Fittest Family. On Monday night, Davy's Toughest Challenge. The finale of Ireland's Fittest Family is this Sunday. It's been wildly popular, and particularly Davy's Toughest Challenge has been really popular. I read one review of it which described you as a shouty saint, which I thought was good. Why do you think it's affected people so much, that show?
I don't know. Listen, it's very, like, it was a big show to take on, number one. It's an age group, personally, myself, I worry about a small bit, that they need a bit of direction. And I wanted to try and work with people who have had different challenges in their lives. I wanted to understand them a bit more. I want to see if we could just give them a small help to get them out of the hole they're in. And I think it's resonated with a lot of people. I think it's resonated with people who've gone through that. I think it has resonated with people that that are saying to themselves, you know what, we don't realise how lucky we have it ourselves. Like, there's a lot of different stuff in it, you know?
So yeah.
I'm just glad, John. I'm glad that people have accepted it and they like it. It was tough now. I found it a tough challenge, but I'm so glad I did it.
Yeah, well, fair play to you. And, you know, I was heartbroken for you and for the lads that, you know, I don't want to give a spoiler, but, you know, Mount Everest comes off the table because of the world we're in at the moment. And you got back on track and literally got back on, albeit a different mountain, but there must have been heartache for a few days for you, even behind the scenes.
Oh, listen, I was out in Everest Base Camp in 2012, and it was an unbelievable 2 weeks I was there, and I suppose the track and the beauty is great, but to see how they live in the Himalayas and to see how simple the people live, and it was a very, very basic life, and I wanted the lads to see that. I wanted them to experience. I wanted time to chat to them, because there's no TVs, no anything out there, so we get plenty of time to chat. Mm. And they were sold on going to Everest, like it's one of the highest peaks in the world, and they wanted to go there. So it was disappointing, John. It was disappointing. But you know what? We made the best of where we were in Ireland and Clare, and it was brilliant. Like, we ended up in Kerry, and it was absolutely amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. And people can see that this Monday night, 9:35. Davy, it's an overused cliche, but you are becoming an inspirational figure for young and old people in Ireland. And thanks very much for chatting to me about your TV career and indeed your favourite movies.
Listen, John, thanks very much. Stay safe, and we'll chat to you again. Take care.
Guys, you're just talking. Talking, la, 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 like this is business as usual. It's not.
We're trying to solve the problem here, Billy.
Not like this. You're not. You're not even looking at the problem.
Well, we're very aware of the problem. I mean...
Okay, good. What's the problem?
Look, Billy. We all understand what the problem is. We have to replace...
Okay, good. What's the problem?
The problem is we have to replace three key players in our lineup.
No, what's the problem?
Same as it's ever been. We've got to replace these guys with what we have existing.
No, what's the problem, Barry?
We need 38 home runs, 120 RBIs, and 47 doubles to replace.
The problem we're trying to solve is that there are rich teams and there are poor teams. Then there's 50 feet of crap, and then there's us. It's an unfair game. And now we've been gutted, like organ donors for the rich,
Boston's taking our kidneys, Yankees taking our heart, and you guys are sitting around talking the same old good body nonsense like we're selling jeans, like we're looking for Fabio. We got to think differently. We are the last dog at the bowl. You see what happens to the runt of the litter? He dies.
A clip there from Moneyball, as chosen by Davey Fitzgerald as one of his two favorite movies. And he's a cool guy. And we had a lot of technical issues before that interview started with my laptop freezing. But anyway, we got there in the end and he was very cool about the whole thing. And as I say, you can see him Sunday night on Ireland's Fittest Family or Monday night on Davey's Toughest Challenge at 9:35 on RTE1. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, I will be talking to Lord David Putnam, the man who produced movies like Midnight Express, Chariots of Fire, Local Hero, The Killing Fields. Very excited about that. On the occasion of his 80th birthday, and his life has gone on to all sorts of unusual and interesting places. So I'm looking forward to that. Just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, the Newstalk app, or wherever you choose to get your podcasts. Or it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. You can get in touch with me at any stage during the week about any TV or movie related business or any business at all, really. You can tweet me John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Anne-Marie Kane helped out on the show this week, as she does every other week, so my thanks to her. Leave you with some music from the movies. One Night in Miami was a brilliant movie from earlier in the year, which we reviewed on this show, all about Cassius Clay, as in Muhammad Ali, Sam Cooke, Malcolm X, all being together, and Jim Brown, the football player, all being together in a room in Miami. A great film, one of the best movies I saw all year. Has a great soundtrack in it. And Leslie Odom Jr. plays the Sam Cooke character, and he also tries his hand at some Sam Cooke songs, and he does a very good job. So I'll leave you with A Change Is Gonna Come, and wish you all a great weekend.
I was born in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Knocking me knocked out.
time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.